So thanks everyone for joining our webinar on insider risk. I'm delighted you can join us today. My name is Brian Martin and I'm Director of Product Management at Integrity360. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Glenn Smith, who is Principal Sales Engineer at Mimecast. Glenn has over 2 decades of experience in the dynamic realm of IT and cybersecurity. He is a seasoned professional who has thrived in a range of roles, ranging from senior pre-sales engineer working with large global organizations to delivering large cloud transformation projects in enterprise environments. Glenn has a deep understanding of technologies and how they work together with security at their inception, and it helps Glenn provide a unique viewpoint to customers and their decision makers. Just to mention that the session is recorded, so anyone who may be interested in watching back or sharing with colleagues, it will be available from the Integrity 360 website. There's also a Q&A function that you'll see at the bottom of your screen. So we encourage questions. So please put any questions you have in, and we will address them towards the end of the webinar. We're also going to run some polls throughout the presentation, so we encourage everyone to participate as much as possible. So, and with that in mind, here's our first poll. And because this topic is insider risk, we'd like just to get an understanding of the audience and the current state on insider risk. So, Clara, could you put up the first poll? Thank you. What is your current state? So, do you have a good understanding of the risks and mitigation controls are mature? Good understanding, but still developing controls around it? Not confident we have a full understanding, and that's why you're here today, and how to mitigate them? We're at an early stage in considering insider risk, or really, you're starting from scratch and would like to learn more about insider risk. So please submit your answers and then we'll come back in a few minutes and just get a sense of the state out there. All right, so just a few thoughts on insider risk. What are the trends? We often hear about insider risk, but what are the trends around it? Well, the trends are that insider risk is increasing and has increased in recent years due to a number of factors. Remote and hybrid working, it significantly expands the attack surface and reduces the visibility within which insiders can operate, you know, whether malicious or non-malicious. The ubiquitous AI tools and Gen AI agents are introducing new insider risks. Both human and autonomous agents can result in data and information being leaked, but that can cause damage to organizations. We've seen an upward trend in threat actors increasingly bribing insiders or exploiting financial stress and workplace dissatisfaction. And obviously, if the threat actor has somebody operating with them on the inside, that can significantly enhance their ability to breach your environment and unfortunately do damage to your organization. And increasingly, more organizations are outsourcing functions. You know, they have contractors, they have service providers operating within the environment. And based on recent stats, 68% of organizations are increasing their use of third parties. And that increases the footprint of insiders within your organization as well. We've seen, you know, just on that third point, direct bribery offers by ransomware gangs. In 2025, Medusa Ransomware Group approached employees and were offering 15 to 25% of ransom payments in exchange for insider access. In the Coinbase breach example in 2025, attackers bribed outsourced customer support workers in India with a $2,500 per person to gain access to internal systems. And yeah, so we're just seeing that increasing trend happening. We've also seen an uptick in and a concerted campaign from North Korea for IT workers to masquerade as legitimate workers and gain remote access jobs to both get paid for doing those jobs, but then also to gain insider access as well for that state actor. So lots of things to kind of be concerned about in terms of insider risk trends on the uptick. Insider threats now responsible for 45% of data breaches. I mean, that's a massive proportion of what is ultimately what we're mostly concerned about in terms of cybersecurity. And the average cost of an insider threat is 17.4 million annually, and that's up about 7% from 2 years ago. And also, detection is slow, I guess, because the insider is supposed to be there. They have authority, they have permission, they have privileges that have been granted to them. So it takes an average of 81 days to contain an insider incident. And as you know, we have insiders, both intentional and unintentional insider threats. Now, Glenn is going to go into this in more detail, but actually 62% of insider incidents are unintentional, caused by, just mistakes, errors, compromised users, negligence. And only, 16 to 28% are actually malicious. And as I mentioned, the third party insider issue, basically a third party insider increases your insider footprint and counts for 14% of incidents. So, in summary, insider risk is a human behavior issue and a challenge that requires, many cross-functional strategies to address. And with that introduction, I'll hand over to Glenn to take us through his part of the presentation. Over to you, Glenn.
Lovely. Thank you, Brian. And it's an absolute pleasure to be able to come and address everyone on the call today. We're gonna kind of have a look at just a correlation between what is termed insider risk and how we go about managing that as a concept. Now, I can remember coming across the term insider risk probably 10 to 15 years ago, and just certainly as a security individual, struggle to really grasp the concept that there's that element of risk from inside an organization. You occasionally heard stories of a rogue admin locking accounts out, but we've really started to see an evolution in how we address this, and certainly some of the examples we're going to look at today, how this problem has matured, whereas the way in which we probably look at it certainly hasn't. So the element of that insider risk is yeah, absolutely. There is that malicious insider whose ultimate goal is to cause some kind of destruction, whether unhappiness or an ultimate grievance. But when we start to look at some of the other activities going on, things like departing employees is hugely prevalent now. We've all changed roles through our careers. The tools we use, the data we've created, certainly in elements where there's development, so DevOps, coders essentially truly believe that the code they've created ultimately belongs to them. So, but more so, and I think you raised a really interesting stat there, Brian, is this accidental, that disclosure of data, loss of data, and that's either through, negligence of that employee, security evader. I think that's certainly a common one. I'll hold my hand up. I'm quite averse to being held back by tools to get my job done. And then, another great point you raised there, we look at the recent ransomware incidents. There's that insider agent, whether it's through blackmail or bribery. So there's a whole new understanding to what this element of insider risk is bringing to organizations, alongside suppliers. One of the biggest breaches was an HVAC engineer who didn't plug into the network. So it's hugely prevalent when we start to look at what's going on in the market. Now we've talked about, certainly like when I looked at it, understanding insider risk was always the it wasn't the the icing on the cake. It was that, yes, we sort of, we know it's there. It's not a big problem. We've never seen it. Well, we didn't know about it. And, you know, it certainly wasn't as prevalent. So most organizations have really focused on securing your internal user base from external. And you can see that, you know, when we start to look at the maturity of you know, some of these frameworks from the likes of Gartner and Forrester, looking at different technologies to ultimately secure your internal user, but really focusing on external. It's very much deemed that external to internal. You know, I need to protect my user base. And it's essentially evolved into how attackers go about targeting users. You know, a common term in our phrase is, you know, attackers don't hack in anymore because it's hard. It's incredibly hard. When you look at the controls in place, you know, unless it's really nation state, it's very hard to get into an organization solely from an external source, without having an element of insider or an element of understanding of that organization, which is ultimately protected. So it's we kind of ended up in this scenario now where almost two-thirds of successful breaches involve that human element, whether that's accidental or malicious. But the correlating spend is still very much focused on securing the network and securing the devices and securing the identity. We haven't really looked at, you know, how do we secure the user and ensure that, you know, what that user is doing, how they're handling data, is front and center and prevalent based on what we're looking at from a security perspective. Now, I've picked a couple of, you know, really common big tech names. You know, we're all familiar with the likes of Tesla and the likes of Google. You know, these are mature technology companies. They have vast amounts of resources. And yet, you know, they're making the headlines. You know, Tesla had, you know, a recent breach where, you know, a lot of information around their self-drive technology was disclosed to media organizations, and it had, you know, catastrophic results based on public confidence from their cars. A Google employee, Anthony Lewandowski, packed up a load of data and walked out of Google into his new job in Uber. That technology relating to their self-drive capabilities. I mean, what a start to a new career. Here's a whole lot of code that's going to make this work. And it's not just, you know, the likes of Tesla, you know, ultimately real technology companies, the likes of Microsoft and Apple. Wherever there is intellectual property, certainly as a prize, we're going to start seeing, you know, individuals targeted with this. So Rivos was a new entry into technology and started actively targeting Apple employees. You know, they hired upwards of 40 of Apple's employees, including one who, again, well, two of them walked out with hundreds of gigs worth of data. That's, you know, related in years and years of development to get to that point. And it's, you know, ultimately there's an ongoing lawsuit from that element. And it's code as well. So Microsoft had credentials leaked to GitHub. And you know, essentially their source code is open to the public. You know, you can buy those credentials online. They've obviously fixed it now, but you know, what a situation to be in as not just a collaboration vendor, but also someone who's prevalent in the sort of security space as well. So how are these companies ending up in the headlines? And it's because I think of the complexity of the problem. You know, when we start to look at, well, how do we secure our users and how do we secure that data? And you know, DLP is not a new technology or a new approach, but it's incredibly hard to get control of your data and yet promote internal collaboration and external collaboration. Organizations, you know, are starting to focus on this a bit more now around, well, how do we classify our data? Well, first of all, we have to know exactly where it is. We have to know every piece of data that we have. We have to then make sure it's classified correctly. Quite often, the users left to make that classification, which, you know, going back to that departing employee scenario, if I want to take that data with, I can mark it as public and ship it out to my Gmail. It's not a difficult process. The challenges around, I suppose, legacy DLP approaches is you then have to have a static rule which is looking for that classification or PII. Now, what if part of your role is to extract information from a CRM system that contains PII and your customer base is largely female users? Suddenly, applying a blanket rule that says no PII leaves the house is not a functional process to provide business capabilities to your customer base. And so we end up with either severe user impact on their abilities to carry out their job roles, or largely ineffective, do nothing and hope that our data is going to where it should be. Agentic AI, probably a year ago, I think DeepSeek made the news. Great AI platform. And everybody chased it. It's the new AI. I need this information. I need that information. I'm a user. I'm able to access this internally. I'm uploading information. One of the proof of concepts we've run recently picked up someone had put a whole RFI document into an agentic AI tool looking for results. It's like, how do you start to restrict your user base from accessing these AI-based platforms? And again, there's absolute use cases for it. The benefits it brings to both users and businesses is incredible. But the problem there is, okay, so we've blocked this agentic AI, we've prescribed this one, but what mediums do we have to do that in? So you end up in a scenario where you have to start, blocking across multiple platforms. What if one's missed? What if one person's allowed? It becomes incredibly hard and difficult to manage these types of scenarios. There isn't a one size fits all, certainly when you start to look at, accessing of data. Now, the one thing we've started to see is, the escalation of that human risk element. Certainly from over time, and there's a lot of focus on human behavior now, rather than just ideally looking at data. Now, in the ideal world, the panacea is everybody works within corporate policy. They only use corporate tools. Everybody does their awareness training on time. Nobody falls for a phish test. But the reality is that's just not today's corporate organizations. Shadow IT. I'm a user. I need to get this file across urgently. It's for a tender. It's for whatever the scenario is. And I can't get OneDrive to work. That's maybe the corporate sanctioned way to share large volumes of files. So the recipient, oh, I've got Dropbox. Oh, I've got a personal Dropbox. Suddenly the user's sending company information via personal Dropbox. How do you know who's got access to that? And it unless that behavior is addressed as a baseline, you then start to get drift. Users, I'm not doing my compliance training. I don't need to do it today. I don't have time. I failed the phish test. It was just accidental. And suddenly, in a relatively short space of time, that user behavior, you've ended up in that breach zone, whether it's small, large, medium, whether it's credentials. It ultimately, it's very much driven by that human risk. So we're going to run a quick poll here. Now, I know we're talking very specifically about insider risk, but the way I see this going, and this is where the sort of this thought element comes into it, is how do we manage that? And that's essentially what human risk management is. It's looking at that addressing that insider risk. Right. So just having a quick look at the poll results, it's a great sign. It seems that almost 65% understand and have started to adopt some form of human risk management, or at least addressing and understanding of the insider risk issue. Luckily, no one's not agreed with, which is great. It means we're certainly on the right track, and the content, the messaging is ideal. So, and what's great about this is this year we've started to see both Forrester and Gartner spin up a new category, which is ultimately human risk management. Now, in my eyes, it's not as mature as when we looked at the workspace sort of frameworks, but it's certainly a start in the right direction, and I think we're going to start to see a lot more prevalence around, well, how do we secure that user, and align it with what we're doing from a control perspective, around the network and an endpoint. Now, I'm not going to run through the entire sort of framework, but when you start to look at the information gathering, it's very similar to an XDR scenario. So, tell me what's happening now, what's in flight. And then we start to look at your SOAR-based platforms. Well, how do we intervene? And that's very much what that framework is looking at. Who's the risky individual? How are they introducing risk? Is it, what's the level of risk? What's their security knowledge? What's their behaviors? And, well, how do we react as an organization to that? The difficulties are when we start to look at this framework is always going to be data. Now, the data from an indicators perspective is quite tricky. And yes, I appreciate it's quite a wordy slide, but I kept this content in here because we'd like to share this afterwards, because it certainly gives you an understanding of how difficult that data movement is, that part of trying to get this human risk management element right. Now, copying a load of files is not necessarily an act of nefarious nature, but it certainly shows an anomaly. Unsanctioned software. We've all, at some stage, I need this tool downloaded, some sort of PDF converter, or I need to convert this to a PDF file now. Hey, there's a free version online. Whoops. Suddenly your intellectual property is stuck on a free base service that nobody really understands what's behind it. And so it really shows with that movement of data, how that user is interacting. And again, it's another key point, data fed element to understanding how that user is interacting with data. Increased requests for access or privileges, certainly when you start to look at scenarios where people are maybe changing roles, similar industries, is there something relevant that I can, take across to a new role? Or trying to access data that's not part of their core job. Is somebody in HR trying to look at tail data, for example? Again, going back to that DLP scenario, we have to know exactly what we're looking for. We have to have the correct channels looking for that classification. But how easy is it to obfuscate data? If I take a screenshot, save it locally as a PNG, rename it to a .zip file and send that out to a Gmail, or copy and paste into a Gmail, how does sort of your legacy DLP tools really have an understanding of it as an element of risk as to what's going on there? Is that normal behavior? And always departing employees, we sort of touched on that. I came into this role, I had previous data, a lot of it was personal. But what's to stop you leaving again with that same data and more? Something intellectual property certainly is a big risk when your sole industry relies on, having something as a USP to your competitors. So for me, the real difficult part is that data, understanding the data. But when we start to look at the bigger picture, we know that, looking at human risk as an element, not everybody has that same risk profile. You can have two people sitting next to each other in the same job. One can always do their training and their awareness training, and hasn't failed for a phish test. But as soon as they get home, they're on everything. They use their work sanctioned laptop to play Java game. That's introducing an element of risk. And so having the insight into that 8%, allows us to start to look at human risk in a different way. Rather than applying things like static DLP rules, we can start to shift left and say, right, who is exhibiting what we determine to be somewhat risky behaviors? And the data-fed centric element of this is really telling us, well, at what level is that risk being introduced? Hopefully you've all seen the minority report, and this is where I see human risk going. The sort of scenario here is Tom Cruise is working with the precognizance and starting to look at not yeah essentially predicting the future. So if a user is introducing risk into us as an organization, there's a very good chance if that behavior goes unchecked, that it's going to end up in some sort of breach of information or loss of intellectual property. And just gives certainly security individuals the ability to react in an automated fashion before it gets to that extent. It's that shift left. Tell me what I don't know. Tell me where my risk lies. And this is essentially where human risk management is going. To give you an idea of what those controls are going to look like, there's obviously awareness training, huge benefits. There's testing to show vulnerabilities. I think the overall approach is very much empowerment, really understanding, well, how do we educate a user? How do we, inhibit, exhibit a user nudge before it gets past the point of no return? Education, awareness, automation around controls. So a user has a prevalence for clicking on malicious links or detonating malware on their sort of local machine. We don't want to have to clean up every machine. It's way easier to stop that event before it happens. And I think when you look at the controls available, certainly across some of the newer human risk platforms, they are directly correlated to the nature and severity of the event. And that's really where I see this automation going. What would these controls look like? So if we go back to that sort of ideal scenario state we looked at earlier. User desperately needs to get a large volume of information across. The tools are not working. There's a bit of frustration. We know what's happening with that data. We have that visibility. We're able to correct that behavior in that scenario, either through a nudge, hey, automation, videos, education, redirection to acceptable use policy, data handling policies. And the user is suddenly aware, look, they know what I'm doing. I've gone against sort of policy there, and I'm being brought back into that safe zone. I've not been let to drift to the point where I'm really introducing elements of risk that are going to endanger data. We've looked at a bit at, sort of what does a human risk or an insider strategy look like? And I personally saw some very, very close similarities here to how organizations have gone around adopting security awareness training. The ultimate or prerequisite is really having engagement from senior leadership. Now, without that backing, it's a fruitless exercise. There has to be that understanding and an appetite. The difficulties then start in, how do we start to identify individuals who have access to that data? Who is, really, really targeted, so that, starts to bring in data from other security controls, so those preventative controls we looked at. How do we define what our risk appetite is when we start to look at, well, what are the reactions? If you're an MOD organization and somebody sends a file out that shouldn't be going to a Freemail address, what is the sort of approach to that? Always, I think, again, there's another similarity to that awareness sort of campaign a lot of organizations run. And that's positive, reinforced positivity. Yes, you haven't clicked on a malicious link. Again, falls under that educational piece. And they're just really reducing that attack surface. And that can, again, a really difficult part is, having to implement controls across multiple sources. I might have access to my collaboration toolset at home on my personal machine. But what's to stop that data going from a corporate sanctioned collaboration tool into the likes of a ChatGPT. I think this will mature a lot. What I'm really looking forward to is, when we get to the ultimate panacea, where you have this ecosystem. And I think if we look at, that Forrester slide I showed earlier around what that framework is essentially going to look like, it's going to expand out. So we start to look at, very much that human risk management centricity, but it's cloaked in awareness, cloaked in understanding, training, education. And then bringing in information from, well, what is happening to, how effectively is a user targeted from external to internal? Those controls exist. Are we seeing a high prevalence at a specific user? Do we have any understanding of that user's maturity in the business? There's a lot of statistics around, longevity and, attack surface. The longer you're at an organization, the more public you are, the more you're essentially going to be attacked, easier to profile. I've certainly seen a shift in how organizations are looking at DLP, and there's that insider risk element. I think gone are the days of static detections. We have to have a much more dynamic AI-based focus around, well, what's normal, what's not? Okay, this is a high-risk event. What do we do about it? Well, we stop it leaving. We have to be in that blocking mode. There's your control. Internal governance. What information is going into all of these collaboration tools, not just your sort of core there, but most organizations will have multiple bits of chat collaboration suites, whether it's Teams, whether it's Slack, we're on a Zoom session. It's bringing that information from HR. How long has an individual been with the organization? Is there a sudden shift in their data management? Are they suddenly possibly looking to leave the organization? And it's that real insight to human behavior around data, but security and compliance, fed from multiple security and DLP tools. It's not just a single source of true indication of what's going on. So I'm going to unashamedly bring us back to my cast. We kind of see this as the next big security focus, certainly from an organization perspective, just because the security controls are so good that are already in place. And this is such an undefined market or an unaddressed risk. And where we're looking to really start bringing all of those tool sets in place. So we've always been a very API-focused organization, but really starting to correlate real-life data, not just from, has a user done training or have they fallen foul of a phish test? That's not a true indication of a user's risk profile, but what's happening on their endpoint? How are they managing data on a daily basis? Are there anomalies there? Well, how is their web traffic? What does that look like? Are they starting to have, multiple failed login attempts, impossible logins, and really bringing that into a much more human data-fed centric risk scoring program? That's kind of what I wanted to run through today. It is very high level. I hope it's really resonated from what I certainly see, that evolution from insider risk to a much bigger picture of how we sort of look at that. So, and I, I've had a great day. I really appreciated everybody's time. So I'll hand back to Brian.
Thanks so much, Glenn. Really appreciate that. Very insightful to see that that whole ecosystem evolving around managing human risk and insider risk. So get your, we're going to get to the Q&A shortly. So I've seen a few good questions already come in. So please get your questions in. Anything that you think either you weren't quite clear about, or even something that wasn't covered that you were hoping to see covered as well, please do put in your question. Before just to move on as well, I just wanted to ask Clara if you could put up the results of poll one. Just wanted to be interesting for everyone to see the profile of where people are in consideration around insider risk. So we'll just have a look at that. Brilliant. Yeah, it's your usual bell curve, I suppose, in that in the middle we've got 55% with a good understanding of the risks, but still working on the controls around it. 9% in a very good strong place, so quite mature controls, good understanding, and yeah, 36% not confident of the full understanding of risks and how to address them. So luckily nobody asking the question what is insider risk, so there's some level of understanding there across the entire audience, which is good. And even though Glenn said poll two was 60 over 60% with understanding of human risk management, it'd be interesting to see the spread as well on poll two, if you could show that as well, just so we can see the full sweep across the audience. So we've got 64% understand human risk and human risk management and have started to adopt it. 14% all over it. And 21% have heard the term, but still early on the journey. And happily, nobody disagrees with the concept entirely that it's something that is a useful tool to manage human risk. Just while we're waiting for any more questions to come in, just to highlight, we've just launched a new managed security awareness service to help organizations address a lot of the risks around this. So, Mimecast are a big partner of us and have great solutions across this whole area of insider risk and human risk management. And we've got a complimentary service for organizations that want help to help put that, to manage that on a more day-to-day and a week-to-week basis as well. So, Glenn, if you want to just move ahead, please. And then just before the Q&A, just to highlight some upcoming relevant webinars. So next week we've got our webinar From Targets to Defenders, Building a Cyber Resilient Workforce in the Age of Deepfakes and Advanced Exploits. So it really dives a bit deeper on that whole area, but obviously highly complementary and highly relevant when considering both insider risk and human risk management. And then the following week, on the 26th of November, we have a if you're in the unfortunate situation of you put all the stuff in place and you still have a breach or you have an incident that needs help, they do happen. As they say, it's a case of if and not when. We have a webinar for that. Breaches happen. Are you ready when they do? So sorry about the bad pun there, but you get the idea that incident response, having that ready to go should something happen and act quickly, is crucially important. So we have a webinar planned for that on the 26th as well. So if you're interested in any of those webinars or indeed our full program, which you can always find on our events website, then you can just follow the QR code on the screen there and you'll be able to find out and register for those. All right. And then moving on then to the next slide, Glenn, please. We're on to the Q&A section. So let me just pull up the questions that we have here. And the first question is insider risk and human risk the same thing? Is all insider risk not human risk and all human risk insider risk? Why do we make that distinction between talking about the topic of insider risk and human risk?
Oh, great. Yeah, great question. And this is just my sort of take on it. I think, we've always been aware of what insider risk is, and that's, a risk that's originating from inside the organization. Now, from an evolutionary perspective, I think, human risk and human risk management is the framework with which, we're going to market to address the insider, risk from a human perspective. So there's absolute crossover. I'd like to probably differentiate the two is, well, how do we deal with insider risk? Well, we have a human risk management platform.
Yeah, and I suppose, in the modern era as well, you could add that AI agents working within your environment have insider access. So in that sense, they're an insider risk potentially, but not a human risk. And then I know in the traditional sense, when we talk about human security and human risk, we tend to think of it in terms of educating and training and testing your workforce or people with inside access, and don't necessarily include the malicious insider risk, that additional whatever 25%, where somebody has been, you can't train a malicious insider to stop doing what they're doing, because they're doing it for a malicious intent. So I think there are subtle distinctions, but as you said, massive overlap between the two.
Again, I think it's just how we interpret it. I think retrospectively, insider risk has very much been data focused, and it's been that siloed visualization of where's my data going. But when you expand that out and start to have a much wider 30,000 foot view of a user's behavior, I think that's the next step in maturity. I could handle that. I could not breach a DLP rule, but if I'm executing malware on a daily basis, I'm introducing risk into the organization, just probably not focused from that data centric element.
Okay, so then the next question, and it's that traditional complaint about, we're trying to catch people out and blame them for making mistakes, that we're trying to trick them to click on that simulated link, etc. So good question here about, even though it's not recommended to name, shame, and blame people for their humanity, when they make mistakes, and we all make mistakes. Anybody can fall foul to these tactics. How do you address the, you quoted a statistic of 8% represent 80% of the risk. How do you address that in a better way? So rather than blaming, how do you address that? And particularly, how do you deal with repeat offenders? Someone who, in spite of the softly trying to nudge them and educate them, that they continue to offend in this space.
Yeah, great question. For me, I think it's when you start to look at policies like guardrails, and it's the evolution of, well, what is the risky behavior? To err is human. So yes, we've all done accidental things. We may have copied and pasted data into a not allowed platform. Where we start to see a repetitive nature of it, I think that correlating event or that correlating control needs to be escalated as well equally. Now, n no, we don't need to name and shame, and that's why a lot of the controls are automated, just like with awareness training. You get a nudge; it's not blown out of proportion, and you end up on the naughty step. It starts to escalate though until the point where, well, your machine is no longer accessible, you can't do anything. There has to be some form of behavior change. If that is not effective, then ultimately that individual has no interest in reducing their risk profile or stopping introducing elements of risk into an organization. And how organizations choose to deal with that, when you start to look at, well, what if they had another element of gross misconduct to some extent, he would be handled through an HR platform at the moment. So I think absolutely automation direct to the user, training, guardrails, controls, exclusion. That would be my, certainly my, the way I would see it.
Very good. Speaking of DLP, which you mentioned quite a lot earlier, is the idea of watertight DLP across all your channels unattainable? I know from my own experience of seeing, many organizations implement DLP or try to, that it can be a quite a fraught process, very taking a long period of time, and almost like, hard to get it right, in terms of, as you say, labeling the data, classifying, and having all the right policies. So what's your thought, Glenn, around like is watertight DLP attainable? Have you seen organizations who've achieved that? Or if not, then what's the answer?
I'll be honest. I personally have never come across an organization that has been brazen enough to say, we absolutely have exactly what we want and need from a DLP perspective. And I've had the benefits of working from really small organizations, 50 seats, to tier one banks who are still struggling to try and stop that gap or close every loophole. Is it a fruitless exercise? Absolutely not. There are elements that are absolute, where blocking technologies is required. But I think the challenge is really to get it right. And I think visibility is far more important. Certainly when you look at the wide array of different channels and different technologies and different devices out there, it's incredibly hard to get.
Yeah, totally agree. Is it considered a risk if developers share the core code to AI agents?
So that's going to depend on the code. That's going to depend on the organization's appetite for risk. I think every organization is slightly different. There are sanctioned AI agents. There's sanctioned repos. So if it was me as an organization, I certainly wouldn't allow it.
Yeah, and isn't it also a case that you've got different types of AI, some of which is learning AI, which actually uses the inputs to and then can spit it out somewhere else to another organization. And then there's types of AI that guarantees to not share the data or use it in its learning models to reproduce it elsewhere. So I think to me that would also be an important thing to
Yeah, I mean,
consider.
I think there's, you're essentially the product when you start to look at, especially free agentic AI. Anything you put in there is it's going to learn and it's going to train. So it's without, more information around what's the nature of that, I think it's quite difficult to respond. It's going to be dependent. But if I was, in an organization that was looking at developing code or applications, there's an absolute use case for, utilizing AI agents, but I would certainly wouldn't use anything public. That's just my take on it.
Yeah, I think in short, without unless it's well investigated and mitigated, it will represent a risk of both leakage of that code, and where it can, intellectual property can be leaked, also the information about the code, how it's constructed, and therefore its weaknesses, vulnerabilities, and security flaws could also become apparent as well. So, I think it's something that would need to be very tightly managed. All right, and then just the last question is more an admin question about whether the presentation will be available on the site. And we don't normally we put up the video, and then the video can be obviously reviewed, in which case you'll see all of the slides again. We don't typically put up the slides themselves. However, if anybody would like access to the slides, please just send in your details, make the request, and we can share it on an individual basis and follow up with you on that basis. And with that, I think we've got through all of our questions. So unless there's anything else, which I don't think there is, it just remains to say thanks, Glenn, for the illuminating presentation. Thanks, everyone, for participating in the polls and in asking all the questions. And hope to see you again on a future webinar. Have a great day.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brian. Really enjoyed that. Everybody have a sort of great Friday as you tomorrow when you ease into the weekend, and hopefully get some R&R. So yeah, it was great. Thank you. Really appreciate it all.